Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 2:34 p.m. We are in Belts Room 105, the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, January 31st. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjork. Senator Bishop is excused today. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LIO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Today, we will have the governor's executive orders on our agenda. There are three of them that have been referred to the Labor and Commerce Committee. Executive Order 127, eliminating the Board of Massage Therapists. Executive Order number 129, eliminating the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. Executive Order 130, eliminating the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. We will begin today's hearing on these executive orders by asking Sarah Chambers to come to the table. Ms. Chambers, thank you for joining us today, and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I am the Boards and Regulations Advisor for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The three executive orders being heard today propose to shift regulatory decision-making from an appointed board to management within the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. As you know, the governor has an ongoing interest in improving the efficiency of state programs, and these executive orders present the potential to further that goal. Today, I'd like to address what the three executive orders would accomplish and what they would not change, as well as alleviate a few concerns we've heard from the public since their introduction. First, what the executive orders will do. First and foremost, these proposals will eliminate each quasi-judicial board overseeing their respective programs, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, and the Board of Massage Therapists, and move their decision-making authority to the department. Under the current delegation of the commissioner, that authority would then rest with the director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. This proposed change reflects how 24 professional licensing programs within the division are currently managed, including many healthcare programs. With efficiency as the governor's motive, this change would reduce timeframes for license application review, ensure swift action when challenges to public safety arise, and reduce wait times in adopting needed regulations. The executive orders are not condemnations of the good work our board members perform. They reflect concerns about how well the existing structures are serving the state and opportunities for improvement. The structure of the board as the decision maker invites inherent delays. It's difficult to convene a group of busy volunteers, including managing last-minute schedule changes that could derail a meeting and accommodating additional built-in delays to meet public notice requirements. Board business may get pushed weeks into the future if a quorum of the board is unable to meet, unnecessarily drawing out the wait to complete board business. We understand how difficult it is for board members to cancel client appointments or request time off as working professionals. However, these conflicts impact a board's ability to function, which cascades down to impact people attempting to become licensed, existing licensees awaiting board answers to questions, as well as negative effects on public consumers. Currently, the wait time for reviewing and adopting regulations is more than doubled when a board is the driver rather than the department. Looking at recent history, a simple regulations change by the division takes about 4 months versus a year when a board has requested a similar change. This impacts the ability of qualified practitioners to enter the market and suspends policy updates impacting license practice. Similarly, license applications may wait several weeks for board members to review, only to be tabled for consideration at a meeting that could be scheduled weeks in advance. This does not happen with department-managed licensing programs. Additionally, a staffing restructure initiated in 2022 and affirmed in the FY25 budget adopted by the legislature provides deeper programmatic support for all licensing programs, something that did not exist before then and which previously contributed to turnover in examiner positions. The same is true for disciplinary matters. Investigations requiring a board member review can often take months, culminating in another protracted process of discussion and final decision-making by the board. Shifting this responsibility to the department will allow investigators to seek input on practice matters from a qualified practitioner only when scope of practice is in question. Potential violations of statutes or regulations that do not involve practice matters can be managed by a staff investigator who's familiar with the program, with a recommendation to the director for final action. Investigative timelines mandated by division leadership in recent years have continued to reduce internal case management turnaround times. Regulation without a quasi-judicial board is a common model across the United States. More than half of Alaska's professional licensing programs are currently successfully managed that way. When you look across the U.S. and its territories, there is no one dominant model of regulation for these professions. Only about half of the professions under the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers are managed by a board in other states and territories. About two-thirds of massage therapy programs are regulated by boards, and only 9 of 34 states that regulate direct entry midwifery have midwife industry-led boards. Shifting away from a quasi-judicial board opens opportunities for the department to hear regular feedback directly from licensees, the public, and other stakeholders. The department is committed to enhancing input from stakeholders, such as establishing advisory committees, opening pathways for electronic communication on proposals for change, holding forums and town hall meetings to seek ideas and feedback on regulation of these professions. And state law will still require the department to seek and consider public input on regulations the same way a board is required to do. The department strongly believes in the need for a solid and transparent bridge between licensees and staff if the executive orders become effective, ensuring that people who've been used to a board structure continue to have an open line of communication on all matters affecting their licenses and their practice. Speaking of which, there have been many concerns raised by stakeholders since the executive orders were announced, so I'd like to assuage some apprehensions about what these orders will not do. The changes made in the executive orders do not alter licensure or certification standards or practice of any of the affected professions. The administration supports the practice of these professions and reinforces that the proposal of these orders is in no way a step toward deregulation. Any change to state law affecting any of these professions would require further action by the legislature, as it does now. Any regulations change would require the department to seek and consider public input, as the law mandates and as boards do now. If a situation arose and it did not have the practice experience required to make an educated decision about an applicant, investigation, or regulation, the department would continue to rely on the advice and wisdom of seasoned practitioners, as it does now with all programs. We've also confirmed with the Department of Health that licensees who are currently qualified for reimbursement by insurance and Medicaid would continue to be covered as they are now. The time currently spent by staff to support management of a board will be reinvested in improving licensing turnaround times and increasing expertise about the profession if there are any gaps that result from the reorganization. Division staff currently receive training and education on matters that are important to the programs, and that will only be enhanced going forward. A great example of this is the training that our staff currently receives on identifying potential human trafficking red flags in license applications and enforcement issues. Board members currently share in this review, but they're not the only trained eyes on these issues when they arise. which is infrequent. The training that division staff receive on human trafficking would only be enhanced when the executive orders go into effect. The previous points apply to all three boards proposed to be eliminated in the executive orders. There are a few specific concerns, however, that are relevant to two of these affected boards. First, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers has multiple times over more than a decade identified needed changes in statute or regulation that would either improve policies relating to the professions that they govern or clarify persistent questions that are creating confusion in the industry. With limited exception, they have failed to act on these major policymaking needs from the industry. The board has frequently needed to reschedule or cancel its publicly noticed meetings due to a lack of quorum. And on multiple occasions, more than a dozen members of the public have gathered to engage with the board, and the board has not shown up. Without the requirement of a board, the department could have moved forward in reviewing these matters and taken appropriate steps to address industry concerns. The board has, over several years and across multiple rotations of members, failed to perform the work delegated to it by the legislature. Not only is this persistently not responsive or responsible to the needs of their practitioners and the public, but it's a drain of staff time and resources that could be spent more productively, particularly on getting people to work in Alaska. Moving quasi-judicial decision-making to the department will also protect the integrity of the process. Within the last year, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives has not been able to address certain application and investigative issues because a majority of board members has had a legal conflict of interest with the subject, either because the board member was their employer or had internal information about the case. The board was required to remand a matter to the administrative law judge to settle the matter for them, resulting in the case taking nearly a year and costing more than $7,000, which will be paid by licensees. The situation, I want to be clear, is no fault of the individual board members. It's the result of a structure of a board of market participants that oversees a very small number of their peers. By governing a pool of only 54 licensees and permit holders, it's inherently difficult not to run into conflicts of interest in application and disciplinary matters. Conflicts that require the board to shift its responsibilities to the Office of Administrative Hearings will only create more expenses for a program that already costs licensees approximately $3,000 to enter the profession as a fully certified midwife, and which must be paid again upon renewal of certification every other year. Also specific to this board is the inability of the administration to fill the physician seat, which has been vacant for more than 2 years. A lack of qualified applicants has made this extremely difficult. This and other concerns have been brought to the legislature multiple times in the last decade. One of the last four recent legislative audits recommended that the legislature look at alternative methods of regulating this profession. Again, let me be clear, this is not a critique of individual board members or of the profession of direct entry midwifery, which the administration supports. It's a flaw in the statutory structure of this particular board. The administration wishes to express our respect for the professional expertise and willingness to serve offered by all board members and our desire to gain that benefit going forward through a more efficient and appropriate means. To close, Mr. Chairman, the purpose and expected outcome of the executive orders are to improve the regulatory efficiency of the affected professions without sacrificing public engagement or safety. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for you and your staff, I think, as much as it is the department. This is the first time we've taken up executive orders in this committee, and I think members of the public as well, and certainly myself, would be curious to know sort of what the process is here. That is to say, if we do disapprove, there are three executive orders, and if we decide we do disapprove of one, What actually is the mechanism by which we do that? So the executive orders are before us. Do we take some sort of positive vote before we pass it back to the full body? Or what does that process look like? Is that something that anyone here can speak to?
Mr. Chairman, this is Sarah Chambers. For the record, my understanding is that one of the assistant attorney generals is online or should be online to answer that question.
Good afternoon. This is Parker Patterson. Can y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, for the record, again, I'm Parker Patterson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Law Civil Division. So I take, and through the chair, I take your question to be, what is the procedure for disapproving this, or how would it go forward? Is that the nature of the question?
Yes. So I know the legislature has the power to disapprove, sorry, through the chair, has the power to disapprove executive orders, and it's been referred to this committee. But I'm curious, sort of, does the committee put together a report to the full body? Do we indicate, pass, don't pass, no recommendation? What actually is the process by which it goes from a committee to the full body? And then for the full body, is it an affirmative vote on a resolution to disapprove? What exactly does it look like?
Through the chair, Senator, I as to the sort of internal process for your committee, I would defer to legislative legal services on that. That's more their area. I can say that with regard to the executive orders themselves, this is what, you can kind of colloquially call a legislative veto. In other words, it becomes law unless an action is taken by the legislature. And for that to occur under the Constitution and under statutes, there has to be within 60 days of the regular session, there needs to be a special concurrent resolution introduced in either house, which is concurred in by a majority of the members in joint session. And if that does not happen, the executive order becomes law on its own without further action at the time that the effective date, which is indicated in the order itself.
Thank you. So I guess, Mr. Chair, if I might ask a question then. So in theory, we could have the special concurrent resolution before us and then, do pass, don't pass, no rec. But we don't have concurrent resolutions before us. We have the actual executive orders themselves, which we can't directly vote on. So is the plan to sort of have a hearing, have a discussion here, but not have any sort of recommendation coming out of the committee itself?
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. As we look at these and what the process will be so the public can know what to expect, we are going to hold a hearing today as well as on Friday about these executive orders, possibly more if needed. Then this committee will produce a report with recommendations on the executive orders, and then anyone in the body can draft a special concurrent resolution to veto or not veto the executive order.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
I didn't catch the Assistant Attorney General's name, but thank you.
His name is Parker Patterson.
Parker, thank you, Assistant Attorney General Patterson.
Are there questions for Mrs. Chambers from the committee?
Okay.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you. Director Chambers, so did I'm sort of curious the process by which the executive branch, came to this conclusion. How much sort of discussion was there with the relevant industries? So we have three before us. Did the executive branch sort of reach out to members of that industry and basically pose the question, do you want us to eliminate this board? And if so, sort of what was the response from those industries?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, executive orders were also fairly new for us as well. So there was no involvement, to my knowledge, with the boards or the industry ahead of the executive orders. That's sort of the launching point for the discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a few questions. as you kind of engage with these boards, Ms. Chambers, through your role, I'm curious to know how long have you been involved with Commerce and kind of interacting with these boards, and what can you describe what your experience has been and roles you've fulfilled within Commerce and interacting with professional boards?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I joined the Department of Commerce in 2011 and served in leadership of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing over 11 years, serving as deputy and division director. And then last year, my current position was created in Commerce to serve our almost 40 boards as board and regulation advisors, really specializing on equipping and working with boards to try to help them do their jobs more effectively and just be an assist for them.
Very good. And over the last 3 or 4 years, do these board members of these three boards, are they participating and helping out with investigations of complaints? How does that process work?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The investigative process is really directed by the division. The division hires investigators who are then certified through a rigorous process to do their jobs well. Board members are brought into the discussion when the investigator has collected all of the data, worked with all of the parties to sort of present a case, and then the reviewing board member, one member of the board, sometimes more if it's a larger board and a more complex case, would review the case and then make a recommendation to their peers on the board. And then ultimately, all license discipline is currently decided by the board. So there's a board member involved in review, and then the remainder of the board sort of sits as judge and jury to make a final decision on whether there should be discipline, no discipline, and if so, what kind.
Okay. Are expected costs or liabilities attached to not having volunteer board members available to assist with investigations and recommendations?
Right now, Mr. Chairman, the division employs or contracts with as needed expert witnesses. Sometimes, by and large, investigations, a reviewing board member is available and has the specialized expertise needed to weigh in on an investigation. But we have a process in place to pull in someone if there isn't a board member that has that specialized information. Maybe they practice in a different area and aren't familiar with it. And so that process is currently already in use. The process that is used right now, board members are pulled in for every investigation, and there's not necessarily, in my opinion, a need for a board member to review something that is not practice related. And so under the executive orders, there would be less demand for board members because most investigative matters are not related to scope of practice per se. It might be a paperwork type of violation. It might be someone was either practicing with or without a license. That's pretty clear to determine. So we would reduce the need for board members because the review could be performed by staff. But we're expecting that with some of the, again, the structural elements of a board going away, that will free up a lot of time that not only licensing staff but investigators are currently spending with board members, that they would then be able to invest in that training and education to be able to do, again, a higher level of work than they're currently doing now. So to bottom line it, I think we're expecting the cost to be about the same. Again, no one can see in the future with the kinds of investigations that might come up, but we're seeing a decrease in work on the board side means an increase in time for staff.
One of the biggest concerns that I've heard from barbers and hairdressers, massage therapists, as well as midwives, has been that these structural changes will take away their institutional seat at the table to craft regulations, expectations, and standards for their individual practices. Does CBPL have expertise in these fields that can help craft these regulations and expectations?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, most of the regulations that are crafted are primarily drafted by staff. The ideas come from the boards, and as I mentioned in my presentation, the department's committed to maintaining that seeking out, proactive seeking out, as well as listening to industry input. And we currently do that with the 24 programs that are managed without boards. When we hear of a concern, a regulation that maybe is outdated, outmoded, needs to change, we hear that from industry. Speech language pathologists and acupuncture come to mind as recent regulation changes that we've worked with industry without a board. And we can get right to making those changes without pausing and holding meetings and evaluating through a larger, heavier structure. So we have that direct connection with industry, with the university system, with licensees to make sure that that evaluation takes place.
Thank you. Further questions for Director Chambers? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. But my question is, when these boards are being dissolved, all the responsibility is now going to fall on the department. What's the fiscal note involved with that? Are you going to have to hire more employees to handle the new workload? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, we don't expect there to be a huge difference in cost, either a savings or an increase. Again, that would depend on the future of the industry and the directions that maybe legislative changes go or the industry desires to go. We already staff up in a way that is currently different than in years past. We started a restructure of the division in 2022 that really uplifted some of the positions to give them more capacity to move in a programmatic space, to understand at a deeper level what are the concerns, what are the trends, what is happening in industry, either in Alaska or statewide, and to be able to synthesize what they're hearing from licensees and board members. That complete restructure of the division is already in place and is really what helps us feel more confident that this is a direction that staff will be able to take up. And I say that because I have full confidence in the staffing structure and the quality and capacity. But by saying that, I want to make sure that I'm not giving an impression that we're cutting out industry input. Again, we want to uplift and build new structures, use more structures we've already tried and are tested and true, to make sure that we're hearing from industry and that we're clearly paying attention to their interest. So we don't have a fiscal note. Fiscal notes are not usually part of the EO process, but again, we're not expecting there to be a dramatic increase in cost from either licensing or enforcement side.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
You may.
Right. Thank you. And I just mentioned the word fiscal note, knowing that you didn't have an actual fiscal note, but in terms of what the cost would be involved. So my next question is, what's the budget for each of these boards?
Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, I could get back to the committee with what the historical costs have been for these boards. The division sets its own budget at the division component level, so there isn't really a budget for each per se. So we could get the historical information to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Director Chambers. At this time, we will hear from Legislative Auditor Chris Curtis.
What are we expecting to go to today?
Ms. Curtis, thank you for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. My name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor. So you have three executive orders that eliminate three occupational boards. And those occupational boards are subject to the legislative oversight process that's outlined in statute, including a legislative audit prior to reauthorization. So I've been with legislative audit over 30 years and been directly involved with the sunset audits of these three boards multiple times. The governor's executive orders eliminate these boards, move those responsibilities, as you've heard, to DCBPL. And before discussing those orders, I want to make it clear that these boards are not funded by general funds. They're funded by occupational, by professional licensing fees. And statutes require those fees be set at a level that covers the cost of regulating the profession. So eliminating these boards will not result in any general fund savings. Also want to make it clear that any increase in regulatory costs that are a result of this elimination will be borne by licensees through the increase in licensing fees. So when considering eliminating these boards, I want to encourage you to consider the impact on the regulatory process, the impact on public safety, and the impact on licensing fees. And I'd like to start off with the impact on the regulatory process. Occupational boards staffed with volunteers. And many of those board seats are staffed or required to be experienced licensees. The board members provide that technical expertise when it comes to crafting those regulations. And they provide that expertise at no charge. Moving the responsibility for creating and amending regulations to DCBPL, I believe, will make it less likely that regulation changes will occur in a timely manner. And I say that because oftentimes it's the board members that identify the need for regulation changes. I also say that because shifting those responsibilities to DCBPL, and DCBPL is an agency that has experienced a lot of struggles. Turnover, recruitment, a lot of struggles in performance. And our audits support that giving them additional responsibilities make it likely that those regulation changes will not be done timely. Also want to say that regulatory responsibility, shifting those to DCBPL, make it more likely that that agency will have to procure additional technical expertise when it comes to crafting regulations. And that comes at a cost. And that cost will be borne by licensees through the increase in licensing fees. Okay, next, impact on investigation process, which in turn is an impact on public safety. As needed, board members are asked to review complaints, and they're involved oftentimes throughout the investigative process, not at the end, but through the investigative process. Oftentimes, they seek, because sometimes these are complicated things. What is appropriate? What's not appropriate? What's the scope of practice? Just to understand a complaint, and if there's a valid reason to move forward with the complaint, they're consulted very, very often, and they provide that technical expertise free of charge. Shifting that responsibility to DCBPL will most likely result in having to procure that expertise, which comes at a cost, and that cost will be borne by additional licensing fees. I also believe it'll slow down the investigative process, and that will impact public safety. Next, the impact on the impact on the investigative process. I do want to mention that I wasn't going to go into the detail of our audits, but I feel after listening to the last presentation that I need to. We have found some very concerning lack of performance at DCBPL when it comes specifically to investigations. And oftentimes we don't disclose the details of that in an audit report because it's an ongoing investigation. But especially with these specific boards, that oversight process has been very important to public safety over the last several years. DCBPL, like the rest of the state government, struggles with recruitment and retention. What I've just heard is not the reflection of DCBPL that we know, and we're in there every year. We're going to be in there this year for several sunset audits. I caution shifting responsibility to an agency that struggles with performance. Our audits show that they should not be provided additional responsibilities until this new reorganization reaps some fruit. this is will be in there this year again, and specifically on the Board of Midwives, which is subject to sunset this a sunset audit this year, and they were only given a 2-year extension last year, last time because of concerning investigations, some things we identified. I also want to I'm going off my notes now, but I also want to highlight that the governor's boards and commissions is responsible for appointing board members and that type of thing. And we have identified problems with board positions not being filled in a timely manner. We found last year a board chair that had been in that position for 15 months because there'd been no replacement made. So some of the concerns that are generating these executive orders prompts my question is, well, why wasn't action taken on boards and commissions to replace board members that aren't showing up or that type of thing? So there is a mechanism out there to address board performance or board members. So my final comment for your consideration is that the legislative sunset process provides an opportunity for legislators to consider whether a board is serving the public's interest. That includes DCBPL support to the board, which we've been very critical of over, I'd say, the last 7 years, routinely. And these executive orders take away that legislative oversight process.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Are there questions for Legislative Auditor Curtis?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your report because you answered the questions that I had. So thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome. Thank you, ma'am. We'll take a brief at ease. We're back on the record, 3:13 p.m. here in Belts 105. Hearing executive orders 127, 129, and 130. We just heard from Division Director at CBPL Chambers and Legislative Auditor Chris Curtis. And now we will go to additional opportunity for questions if folks have questions. Director of Legal Services, Emily Nauman, is online, and Rob Carpenter from the Ledge Finance Division is also here available for questions. Are there any questions for Ms. Nauman or Mr. Carpenter? Seeing none, we'll go to invited testimony at this time. Speaking first to Executive Order 127, we'll have the Chair of the Board of Massage Therapists, Annetta Atwell, join us and provide us with her perspective as a Board Chair of Massage Therapists.
She's muted.
We can't hear you yet, ma'am.
Hear me now.
Yes, ma'am, we can.
Fantastic. Through the chair, thank you, Senator Bjorkman and esteemed committee members, for the invitation to testify in regards to Governor's Executive Order 127. My name is Annetta Atwell. I am a licensed massage therapist who has been privileged to sit on the Alaska Board of Massage Therapy for the last 2 years. I currently sit as the chair of the board for these incredible 2 weeks. The current Board of Massage Therapists have unanimously agreed to seek your action against the governor's executive order to eliminate the Alaska Board of Massage Therapists. We have constructed a letter that should be sent out to each of you through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development on our behalf. The governor has set this order into action to increase the efficiency of the massage therapy licensing process. Although these intentions appear to be respectable, The board believes that his proposal will fail to meet his objectives. Unintentionally expand human trafficking and prostitution within the massage therapy profession and undermine the professionalism that properly trained and licensed massage therapists have worked diligently from which to distance ourselves. Regarding the efficiency of time, the Division of Professional Licensing is already responsible for processing the majority of the massage therapy licensure applications. The board set out to create a more efficient way of processing applications that were from applicants who properly completed all the necessary paperwork with all attached documentation and without a yes answer on their fitness to practice attestation, which indicates a charge or conviction of a crime or revocation of a professional license. This project was steered by Chair Motz as a project by the board without any prompting from the state or department. We heard the cry of our fellow therapists when the licensing process was taking 2 to 3 months after COVID. The board took action. The turnaround time for an applicant that must go through the board's hands is 5 to 7 business days once the board receives it. This project was steered by Chair Motz. If the Board of Massage Therapists is dissolved, the Division of Professional Licensing will need to rubber stamp these applications in the name of efficiency or spend more time in review of applications with red flags from states that have lower standard of education or reinstatements of licenses, essentially decreasing the anticipated gain of efficiency and increasing the cost to the massage therapist in fees to pay for the additional hours of review by state employees. Regarding economic efficiency, the board consists of volunteers who meet quarterly. 3 of the 4 meetings are done through Zoom, meeting once yearly in person. Massage therapist licensing fees fund the cost of these meetings and other administrative expenses, not the general fund. If the state eliminates the board and utilizes compensated industry experts for the investigative reviews, fees will most certainly increase to the therapists. Regarding human and sex trafficking, the state already recognizes that this abhorrent evil masquerades behind the occupation of massage therapy as per Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking website. Professional and vetted massage therapists possess the skill set to identify the small nuances of this criminal activity. Without the experience of the massage therapy board, predictions fear state employees will miss some of the signs of human trafficking and questionable applications. I, as a licensed massage therapist, am greatly concerned that the Division of Professional Licensing through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development is already understaffed as per automated responses to emails after business hours. They state that they are understaffed. How will they take on these extra duties of processing, investigating, and procuring vetted, qualified industrial professionals for peer review? If the staffing deficit is rectified, why have the email responses not been updated to reflect such a status? In addition, the website for the licensed therapist is not kept up to date within a reasonable time frame. Board meeting notes have been unavailable for many months after meetings concluded on many occasions. There are challenges to doing business online. We understand that. Our former chair sought intervention of the website updates on several occasions with delayed reactions from the department. I am concerned, esteemed senators and representatives that are present today, that the state will not direct time, money, and effort to support our industry with continual education about national professional standards, testing procedures that will change, and additional threats to our precious careers. I want to be respected for my knowledge and professionalism as a massage therapist in the healthcare profession. I want every therapist to be safe to do their jobs, educated for their tasks, and safe to the public regardless of their application of massage therapy venues. The Massage Therapy Board considers all challenges the Alaska massage therapists face because we are therapists too. Placing a priority on meeting the needs of therapists, we are passionate about closing loopholes for bad actors that taint our credibility, creating a smooth licensing transition and keeping fees at a minimum. Therefore, the Alaska Board of Massage Therapists urgently requests that this committee halt the forward motion of Executive Order 127. Thank you for this opportunity to represent many voices of the licensed massage community and specifically the Board of Massage Therapists today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Atwell. For records, we need to know your location. Where are you on the world today?
I am in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Very good. Thank you, ma'am. Are there questions for Ms. Atwell? Hearing none, before we move to the next executive order, I want to let members know that on Friday we will speak with the immediate past chair of the board, which Ms. Atwell referenced, Jill Motz. She'll be online to discuss this executive order. She's not available today. Next up to speak to Executive Order 129, we'll have the chair of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers on Teams, Michelle McMullen. Ms. McMullen, thank you for joining us today and welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Michelle McMullen. I have been on the board for 7 years. I have been chair for about 4 years. Post-COVID, I took the position and then pretty much had a whole new board of members. So we've been dealing with training and also dealing with all the little hot spots. We also, during that time, dealt with the microneedling being added to the tattooing definition. And that created a hot spot for us because microneedling in no way is considered part of tattooing. It was not added by us. We did not catch it before it was voted into legislation and statute. We are a self-sustaining board to top that all off. But with this, being on this board for so many years, pre-COVID, we were supposed to start working with the DEC to update their licensing and changes. And with all of these concerns, update their licensing and statutes and regulations to allow us to use it to hire a health and sanitation inspector that could do our health inspections and sanitation inspections, which has not been done and was dropped by the DEC almost 30 years ago. So we've been, these are all ongoing things. I ask pretty regularly, have we heard back from the DEC about regulation changes? And I do not feel like there's been any communication there. We also have the microneedling and tattooing. Like I said, don't know who added that last word. They didn't realize it wasn't for tattooing. We also have been dealing with a major uproar from our estheticians because right now, with how fast trends are changing and the difference that doctors and nurses are all now offering beautifying services, which are for cosmetic beauty, and then we have our estheticians, there's a line that needs to be drawn to define what an esthetician is capable of doing and what type of machines they're able to use compared to what doctors and how deep doctors can go within their scope. A good example of this is the microneedling machine. Microneedling itself goes past the depth of the dermal layer, which our AG stated is the layer that estheticians are allowed to work to, compared to microneedling, which go past set depth in a medical setting. That machine also can be used in a way that allows for estheticians who are not under a doctor's scope of practice, used for what we call exfoliation, and to give a really healthy type of exfoliation. And also, so there's been a lot of that issue going on right now, and it's caused a large uproar, and we've been trying to deal with it as it comes along and be under fire, which also backseats the fact that we're still trying to move forward with communication with the DEC to also get these health inspections. And I do feel that the state has broken down communication as a board member and being on a volunteer basis. I'm basically told that I'm not to speak to these other departments and that the state would handle it for me. And so I ask all the time, am I allowed to do this? You know, can we do this? What's going on here? And we're still waiting. That's been a stop point for us in several factors. I do have a lot of issues with the boards and commissions appointing people who basically no call, no show our meetings. And I've asked several times, can we get other people in here? I just spoke to three different people who said they had applications in. They were waiting to hear back. They would be able to fill the seats of the hairdresser, the barber, public person, our public participant, all of these different positions. And they're like, we want to show up for meetings. We want to know what's going on. So it's very hard for me to see that. I know all these people that have put in their application several times and they're not getting appointed, but then those that are appointed have no-showed us on several occasions with no unexcused absences, as I'll call it. I know we're not in school, but that's the best way to explain it. And also dealing with boards and commissions, we've had, I would almost say favoritism happen, where they would appoint somebody and say, well, we want to keep estheticians doing whatever they want to include microneedling with radio frequency, which is a very high in-depth machine that should only be used in a medical setting. So that sort of pushing for new members is, by my means, completely inappropriate, because I would never, ever want to see an esthetician use this type of machine outside of a doctor's office, you know, if we ever move forward with advanced aesthetics. And there's a lot of, I feel like as a sitting on the chair, I don't get a lot of transparency when it comes to dealing with other departments that have a piece of my industry in it. Say the department of the DEC, they hold our building inspections and sanitation inspections. They only inspect tattoo shops. Tattoo shops are less than 10% of my industry. I know that I'm the one that holds the licenses for tattooing and permanent coloring cosmetics, but what about the other 6,000 people that need to be inspected for health and sanitation? Let's make sure that, you know, all these nail shops and hairdressers are actually cleaning their instruments between each client, because that is a big major safety concern. A health inspector has been a priority, but then we become under fire for microneedling, this microneedling mishap, and also the aesthetics and dermalites, which I'll come into here in a moment.
Ms. McMullen.
So after the, yes.
I need you to wrap up, as we have a couple of other testifiers in our time window.
Okay. I am able to come back on Friday, but all in all, I feel like as a board member, we're not given transparency and communication to be able to do the job that needs to happen in order to make sure that our industry is doing what it needs to protect not only our public, but our licensees, so that they are able to do fair market work like the rest of the states.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Next, to speak to Executive Order 130, we have the Chair of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives on Teams, Bethel Belial. Ms. Belial, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and location for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Through the chair, my name is Bethel Belial, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I have worked throughout Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley. I am a certified direct entry midwife since 1999, and so I am that expertise that Ms. Curtis mentioned in her testimony. I have been serving on the board of direct entry midwives since March of 2020, and I just received my recertification and was re-upped for another 4 years, because I feel like our board is needed in our state. Our board of certified direct entry midwives is unanimous that we are opposing Executive Order 130 that seeks to eliminate our board. We do not believe that it is in the best interest of the state, our economy, and most importantly, public safety, because we midwives serve on the board for public safety for the women and children of Alaska, not for ourselves. We have also crafted a letter that was sent to every senator and every legislator that really breaks down a lot of the information we're talking about. But I did want to mention a few things that were mentioned in Ms. Chambers' first intro. We have been meeting as a board. I've been a chair for 4 years, and we've only not met quorum one time. but we served our community throughout the pandemic and throughout every single recommendation that the two audits that I've been a part of have recommended. Our last audit was October of 2022, which is easily found. Our revenues was $142,000, and our board operates completely in the black. We do pay $2,800 every 2 years to be licensed, and we are willing, as a community of midwives, to maintain that. But as was mentioned, there is a good possibility that if this board is eliminated, our costs will greatly raise. And if midwives cannot afford to pay for our license, then midwives will not be in this state. Midwives, based on the most recent vital statistics report that came out this year for 2022, midwives approximately saved the state just for the time of labor and delivery $5 million just in Medicaid. That is an amazing amount of money. And then we're concerned that if there are less midwives, there's less access to care, and then less women are getting quality care. We have every single one of our audit dings on our report reference the department. We do not have staffing. That's been told to me over and over at meetings. We do not have the staffing. Sorry, we can't do that. We don't have the staffing. Ms. Chambers mentioned an application that was delayed for a year and cost our board $7,000. But what she didn't mention was that application originally was lost for several years, and there was miscommunication at the department level, not at the board level. And so, because we were having to look very closely at the audit from 2022 that said we need to be very careful as board members, we took that very seriously. And yes, that did increase the time frame, but the original problem was mishandling of that application by the department. These types of comments that we've heard through the other chairs of mismanagement or lack of staffing is rampant, and we are very concerned that it's going to continue. We have been working to craft legislation to match our regulations to our statutes for the last 3 years. We currently have House Bill 175 that actually reduces the strain on the department. It reduces the strain on the government, and brings our profession to a nationwide level. There's a lot of information in that bill that actually streamlines our application process, streamlines our relicense application, and puts the onus of carrying that burden onto our national organization called the North American Registry of Midwives. So as we are looking through the things, the efficiency that this executive order is supposed to do, we've been working on that. And that is something the regulations and the statute changes that the board has brought to the department, not the department brought to the board. And so we firmly believe that midwives need a board of our peers, we need a board of our expertise, and that we are doing a really good job meeting the needs of our state and the concerns of the women and children in this state. So we urge you to vote no on approving Executive Order 130.
Ms. Belisle, thank you very much for your testimony. Our final speaker today on this executive order, or Executive Order 130, is the president of the Midwives Association of Alaska, Onika Sprokief. Ma'am, if you could please state your name and location for the record and begin your presentation.
Yes, thank you. My name is Onika Sprokief. I am the president of the Midwives Association of Alaska, and I'm a licensed direct entry midwife. I practice in Anchorage, Alaska, and surrounding area, and today I am in Kelowna, British Columbia, Canada, and that's where I'm calling in from today for a family visit. I wanted to back up what Bethel had said already, that as a group of midwives, we unanimously agree that We are in opposition of Executive Order 130. I've been practicing in Alaska for over 12 years, and staffing issues at the department level have time and time again been proven to be a shortfall. They don't understand our profession, and a lot of time is spent, and time and money has been spent in the past, bringing state employees up to an understanding of what midwives do. And I believe that is the current case for the Board of Direct Entry Midwives, that they don't currently have a licensing examiner that is capable of helping the board at this time. And I believe Sarah Chambers herself is doing that position. I just wanted to also note that that midwifery has been part of Alaskan way of life. It is a part of Alaskan way of life. We serve a small number of women, but we serve women and their families at a rate of four times as high as other Americans choosing midwives and out-of-hospital birth. And I do believe that executive order would restrict our trade and in turn restrict the ability of Alaskan women and their families to access midwifery care. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you, ma'am. Are there any final questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we'll set these EOs aside until Friday's hearing, when we will meet again on the 2nd of February, where we will hear public testimony on Executive Orders 127, 129, and 130. As there is no further business before Senate Labor and Commerce today, this meeting is adjourned at 3:37 p.m.